Program. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners on KZFR and all the people who are in the studio tonight. I'm looking out on some beautiful faces, and I'm really anticipating that there'll be many, many people in the Northern Sacramento Valley who'll be with us tonight to hear Medea Benjamin. And excuse me for that. Medea Benjamin is both a free spirit and a focused activist and author. She has a master's degree in public health from Columbia University and in economics from the New School. She worked for 10 years as an economist and nutritionist in Latin America and Africa for the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, the World Health Organization, the Swedish International Development Agency, and Institute for Food and Developmental Policy. From 1979 to 1983, Benjamin lived and worked in Cuba. Benjamin co-founded the San Francisco-based Global Exchange, which advocates for fair trade alternatives to corporate globalization. In 2002, after 9/11, she co-founded Code Pink, Women for Peace, which advocates an end to the war in Iraq, the prevention of future wars, and social justice. In 2009, Benjamin began her efforts to bring attention to the effects of drone warfare, participating in demonstrations at the United States bases where drones are piloted and headquartered and the headquarters of drone manufacturers. On April 28, 2012, in Washington, D.C., she was responsible for organizing the first ever international drone summit with lawyers, scientists, activists to kick off an international campaign to rein in the use of drones in the United States and abroad. On April 30, 2012, she called out the innocent civilians murdered by drone strikes in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen by interrupting a speech on United States counterterrorism strategy given by John Brennan. Since then, she's interrupted many more speeches and hearings of war makers. In October 2012, she organized a delegation to Pakistan to protest U.S. drone warfare. While in Pakistan, she met with drone victims' families and forged an incredible alliance with Pakistani people opposed to drones above their sovereign nation. In 2012, she authored Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, followed by Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. She has won many awards. I think I won't mention them here, but her latest book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is part of a campaign to prevent war with Iran and promote normal trade and diplomatic relations. We are honored to have her with us tonight to inform us about the highlights of this book and to help us deepen our understanding of the U.S.-Iran-Middle East relations so we can articulate the path toward peace.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be on this community radio station, KZFR, and to be with you in Chico and the surrounding areas. It's funny in the introduction talking about me interrupting this and interrupting that, and people say, well, what if somebody interrupts you? And I say, all the power to them. I would love it. And I actually do get interrupted quite a lot. So if there's anybody who wants to interrupt, feel free. Because it makes us, you know, kind of liven up. But when I get interrupted, unlike when I interrupt, I invite them to come up and actually take the mic and address people. Because I think that one of the problems we have in this country is not getting the full spectrum of views that we deserve to get. And we certainly don't get it from our corporate media. And that's why we so need our community radio station. So thank you to KZFR for keeping people informed of the real news and the wide spectrum of views. So I don't want to start talking about Iran before acknowledging what's happening in Korea. And it is quite remarkable that we're just on the heels right now of this amazing summit between Donald Trump, boo, and Kim Jong-un. We'd probably be booing very loudly if we lived in North Korea and didn't think we'd get caught. Because I've been to North Korea. It's not a place where you can openly express your views if your views are different from those of the great leaders that has been basically one family. But we have to recognize that that is a country that is still feeling the effects of the 1950s brutal, brutal Korean War. And, you know, I'm Jewish, and I sometimes hear from people, oh, you Jews are always talking about the Holocaust, and why do you harp so much on the Holocaust? You know, that's seared into the memories of generations of people, just like the horrors of the Korean War are seared into the minds of generations of Koreans. And I don't think people in this country understand that and how that traumatic experience where the country was leveled, 80% of the buildings were destroyed, there was nowhere else to bomb. And there are older Koreans that I've been to North Korea, and they will tell the visitors what it was like during that time, their memories of the trauma. And of course, this is taught to people in the schools. I was in North Korea in 2015 as part of a group called Women Cross the DMZ. And this was a wonderful group of women from around the world that came together to say, how can we as women be pushing for an end to this 70-year-old conflict? And we started out in the north, where we met with the official women's organization, because that is the women's organization. But we had fabulous exchanges with the women talking about what happened to them in the past and what they would like to see going forward. And then we crossed over to South Korea. This was only a couple of years ago, but it was a different government in power in South Korea and a totally different time. And in fact, some of the older generation of South Koreans so hate the North that they said anybody like our group that had spent time in North Korea and was talking about peace, we were dupes of the North Korean government. And so they were waiting for us as soon as we crossed the misnamed demilitarized zone, because it is the most militarized zone in the world. And we got across, and all of a sudden, we were taken aside by South Korean women who said, uh-oh, be careful, be careful. We have all these police here, and we were surrounded by police because there were rumors that people wanted to throw acid on you. They're so upset that you were in North Korea. And we were scared. Everywhere we went, we had to be followed. In fact, outside the hotel we were staying, we were being guarded all the time. That was the atmosphere just 3 years ago. It's quite remarkable to see how things have changed. And I know that there are a lot of people listening to this radio station that do not like Donald Trump and don't know how to react to the fact that Donald Trump has done a good thing. Well, I'm going to tell you how to react, which is, it is not really Donald Trump that did a good thing. It is the people of South Korea who did a really good thing. And Donald Trump is being swept along in the peace train that the people of South Korea started. And let me explain why that is. Because in South Korea, unreported and very underreported by most of the mainstream media in the United States, there was an amazing candlelight revolution. It happened in November of 2016, it started, and it was against the corruption of the government in power at that time, a woman. Her name was President Park, and people started coming out on the streets against her. And little by little, these protests grew and spread all across the country. And this went on November, December, then into 2017, January, February. By March, One out of every three people in South Korea had participated in these candlelight vigils. That's a country of 50 million people. That means over 15 million people were out on the streets. Quite remarkable. What were they asking? They were asking their elected leaders to impeach a corrupt president. Sound good? Yeah. And they were successful. And so they got President Park out of power, and in came new elections and what was called a miracle of democracy. They elected a new leader, President Moon, on a platform to both get rid of the corruption internally as well as find a path for peace on the Korean Peninsula. That was his mandate. He came in with a determination to find a way to make peace. And he has been doing masterful diplomacy, sometimes openly and sometimes behind the scenes. You didn't see him in the summit in Singapore, but were it not for him and the people of South Korea, that summit would have never taken place. And as we worry about how might Donald Trump mess it up as it goes forward, think that the people of South Korea are determined to move forward no matter what Donald Trump does. Their president and the chairman in the North are going to open up the family reunions so people who haven't seen their families for decades can visit each other. They're going to open up the economic zone called Kaesong, where there is capital from the South and labor from the North. They're going to open up more people-to-people kind of ties like we saw during the Winter Olympics. And this, they feel, is the best way to ensure that the movement for peace is going to just gather more and more energy. Now, we don't have to worry just about Donald Trump mucking it up. We also have to worry about the hawks on the left and the liberal Democrats, the hawks on the right and the liberal Democrats on the left, because already we see letters written to Donald Trump by Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, by Dianne Feinstein from here in California, saying, we're not going to just ratify anything that you want to do. We want to make sure that it is total denuclearization, that there will be no lifting of any sanctions until that happens, that you're going to add in the ballistic missile things, and on and on and on. And so we do have to put pressure on our elected officials like Dianne Feinstein to say, this is not about party politics. This is about 75 million people in the Korean Peninsula who deserve to live without fear. And we have to love peace more than we dislike Donald Trump. It is quite ironic, though, that Donald Trump is meeting with the leader of perhaps the most authoritarian regime in the world, and meanwhile, in Iran, where there is a comparatively much more democratic, vibrant society, he is doing just the opposite. It's also quite ironic that when you look in the Middle East at who the United States is allied with, when we go around the world preaching democracy, but don't want to, as a US government, criticize the incredibly repressive actions of the Israeli government, and instead give them billions of dollars of our tax money every single year, over $3 billion. And then when you look at the Muslim countries in the Middle East, the U.S. is allied with the most repressive one, and that is Saudi Arabia. I did a book on Saudi Arabia because I thought it was so important for people to understand just how wrong it is that the United States is allied with a regime that is so repressive internally and is using U.S. weapons to cause the greatest catastrophe in the world right now in neighboring Yemen. And as we are here tonight, let us think for a moment about the suffering of the people in Yemen. It's already been so bad that not only have there been so many thousands and thousands of deaths, but over course of the last 3 years, the worst outbreak of cholera that we've seen in recent history, with over 1 million people affected, most of them children, and the very port where most of the humanitarian aid comes in, the port of Hodeidah, is right now being attacked by the Saudi-led coalition with the Emirates, and it could mean that there will be a very, very difficult time getting humanitarian aid to the people. A lot more people are going to suffer and die. And the blood of the Yemeni people is on our hands because it's our weapons, it's our planes, it's our logistical support. And so we have to take a minute to really think about our alliance with the Saudis, the Emirates, and what it is doing to create so much death and suffering in the poor country of Yemen. Let's also remember that Saudi Arabia, 15 of the 19 hijackers of 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia, while the U.S. accuses Iran of being the greatest exporter of terrorism. We should look at what the Saudis have done to spread their perversion of Islam, the Wahhabi version, and how that has formed the basis of the extremist groups from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. We should also look at the extremism that the United States has helped to foster by our invasion of Iraq in 2003, and how that invasion has spiraled out of control and just affected the entire Middle East. So when you talk about the largest state sponsor of terror, I think the U.S. could certainly contend with the number one place right there. But let's look at what has been the relationship of Iran and the United States. In the book on Iran, I don't do justice at all to the beautiful 2,500-year-old history of Iran. And I know we have one Iranian in the audience tonight. And thank you for being here. And do we have any other Iranians or anybody who's been to Iran? No, except for Tig Barry in the back there, my partner from Code Pink, who has been to Iran, and I've been there several times. It is an incredible 2,500-year history that I unfortunately run through in a few pages to get to more modern-day discussion of the relationship between Iran and the West. And so I spend more time talking about the 1900s when the first Shah came into power, the dynasty that was created, the repression, the corruption of that time, and how he gave away the keys to the store by giving the oil, the riches of the Iranian people, away to a British company, at that time called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, today known as BP. And how the Iranian people rose up in the most democratic of fashions to say, we think that oil should be for us, not for the British, and elected somebody with that mandate. And that was Mohammad Mossadegh, elected prime minister in 1951, and immediately in power started to carry out that mandate. The British government, and of course the oil company, horrified by this, convince the United States that this could not pass, because not only would it be a problem in Iran, but what about other oil-rich countries that would want to do the same thing? What about neighboring Iraq? What about across the oceans in Venezuela? And so the CIA got involved, orchestrated a coup to overthrow the democratically elected government. Now, just think about this when you turn on, if you turn on, the corporate media today, especially maybe MSNBC or CNN, you will hear nonstop talk about Russia meddling in the internal affairs and the elections of the United States. Well, that's not a good thing. We don't want anybody meddling in our elections. But just think a bit about the history of the United States, not just meddling in elections, but actually overturning democratically elected governments. And at that time, it was seen as a great success, because indeed it was successful. They brought the Shah back in. And in fact, so, quote, successful that they used the same model the next year in Guatemala to overthrow Jacobo Arbenz. They used the same model of covert CIA actions to overthrow Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. They tried to use the same formula to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba. That one didn't work. But when you say, quote, successful model, you have to look at what are the consequences of that. And the Iranian people are living today with the consequences of that. Because when the Shah was reinstated, he became even more repressive because he had to fight all the dissent and used more and more of the oil money to buy U.S. weapons. In fact, in 1969 and then in the 70s, became the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons, using those weapons to repress his own people. People were killed, they were jailed, they were forced into exile. Meanwhile, they were organizing against the Shah. Well, where were the only places that people could really gather together to organize? It was in the mosques. And so the clerics, the Islamists, had the upper hand. When in 1979, the Shah was finally overthrown and Ayatollah Khomeini came back from exile, there was a lot of division about what kind of government would be put in its place. Some people wanting a secular government. Some people wanted an Islamist government. Some people wanting a hybrid where you would have a constitution. The ones who won out were the more conservative Islamists who gave the supreme leader way too much control over the most important aspects of political life in the country. And so you have developed over the years a system where there are some elements of democracy, but there is a lot of repression. There's no freedom of speech, freedom of association. While there are elections, there is a guardian council that vets who can run and who can't run. But in the meantime, right after the revolution took place, the Jimmy Carter, who was president at that time, acceded to the request of the Shah to be given asylum in the United States. He came to the U.S. for cancer treatment. This was seen in Iran, especially by the young students who were the most active, as a sign that the U.S. was going to come in and do a counter coup, that the revolution, they were going to take over again. So what did the students do? They took over the U.S. Embassy. They held 52 Americans hostage for 444 days. And that led to a severing of relations between the U.S. and Iran, relations that have never been reestablished. And it led to the first sanctions against the Iranian economy, sanctions that have been in place in greater and lesser degrees ever since then. And so if you fast forward until the time of Barack Obama, that is really the moment that we had to change the course of relations with Iran. And after a series of very, very difficult negotiations that had gone on for years, it was finally announced in March of 2015 that there was a deal around Iran's nuclear it wasn't called a treaty. It was called an agreement, a nuclear agreement, which meant it did not go to be ratified by the Senate, which was a big problem. But in the meantime, it did have a lot of weight because it wasn't just an agreement between the U.S. and Iran. It was also negotiated by the French, the Germans, the British, the Chinese, the Russians, ratified by the European Union, unanimously ratified by the Security Council at the United Nations. So it was seen as quite a weighty deal. It was also seen as one that was working because the agency that is responsible for the monitoring, the International Atomic Energy Association agency, 10 times did a report saying that Iran was complying with the deal. But because it wasn't a treaty, and Obama didn't make it a treaty because he was afraid it wouldn't pass the Senate, because you need not only a simple majority, you need a two-thirds majority, and in the heated political climate, he didn't think he could get it. So Trump came in, and it was easy for him because he had been lambasting the deal during his whole campaign to pull out of the deal. Now, when he pulled out of the deal, let's just look at what were the sides. I told you, the entire European Union, the entire UN Security Council had said this is a good deal. Trump went against all of them. He went against the moderates inside Iran because President Rouhani is somebody who staked his reputation on this deal of saying, yes, you can negotiate with the West, and this will lead to an improvement in our economy, whereas the more conservative people inside Iran said, never trust those Western devils. You can't, they are, you know, you sign a deal and it's not really a deal. Who was right? The conservatives were right. It was a deal, and Donald Trump pulled us out of the deal. On the other hand, who was Donald Trump siding with? Not only the most conservative elements inside Iran and giving them more power, but also he was siding with the Saudis, who never wanted that deal to be implemented, and he was siding with Israel. Israel, even during the negotiations, when Secretary of State John Kerry was negotiating, afterwards he said the Israelis were coming to him constantly and saying, don't sign that deal, bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. Now think about that for a moment. Does Iran have nuclear weapons, yes or no? No, Iran does not have nuclear weapons. Does Israel have nuclear weapons, yes or no? Well, I don't know how you know it because they don't admit it. The world knows that they have about 200 nuclear weapons, that they have been lying about their nuclear weapons program for decades, and that they have refused to join the non-proliferation treaty like the Iranians did. They have refused to allow any kind of inspection inside Israel, and yet Bibi Netanyahu has the gall, or maybe I should say the chutzpah, to say that Iran cannot be trusted and that the Iran nuclear deal is something that Donald Trump should withdraw from. So Donald Trump listens to Netanyahu, listens to the Saudi, and then of course listens to his own hawks that he brought into his administration, and that is Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Boo! John Bolton hates the Iranian government. Mike Pompeo hates the Iranian government. They have been going on and on about the problem is not just the nuclear issue. The problem is about Iran's meddling in the region. Now, what does that conjure up to you, Iran meddling in the region? Iran is in the region. They live in the region. That is their region. If there's anybody meddling in the region, it is the U.S. military that has been causing such havoc. But The Iranians have also been involved in conflict in the region, and they have now become part of these proxy wars where the Syrian people are the ones who are suffering so terribly because you see the Saudis and the Iranians fighting it out in Syria, the US and the Russians fighting it out in Syria, the Turks and the Kurds fighting it out in Syria. You see Iranians that have helped to create Shia militias inside Iraq that have caused a lot of trouble for some of the Sunni neighborhoods, been responsible for some of the ethnic cleansing. So Iran does not have clean hands, but certainly they are not the worst in the region. And one thing is absolutely certain, which is there will never be an end to the conflicts in the Middle East unless Iran is sitting at the table as well as the other countries in the region. And so if you continue to isolate Iran, what you're doing is making sure that the conflicts will go on and on and on. Meanwhile, we have to ask, what do the Iranian people want? Well, it's hard to know because it is not a totally open, free society, as our friend from Iran who just got back can tell us. But the Iranians that I talk to, some of them hate their government and some of them like their government, but would like to see changes in it. They say, we do not want the U.S. to militarily invade our country to create change because we look around and we see what the U.S. has done elsewhere in the Middle East and it does not look pretty. They look at Iraq and they see the mess that the U.S. created there. They look at Libya, they see the absolute disaster that happened after Gaddafi was overthrown there. They want to see reforms of their own government and they want to be the ones who do that. Well, you have people like John Bolton, who has his own ideas about what he would like to see happen in Iran. And we get an inkling of that because he is very close to a group that has zero base inside Iran, but has a base outside of Iran. And that is a group known as the MEK, the Mujahideen Al-Khalq. And this is a group that was actually a leftist group in the 1970s organizing against the Shah. But when they lost the battle after the Islamic Revolution, they turned on the Iranian government, and then immediately on the heels of the revolution came a war with neighboring Iraq, where Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. It was a bloody war in which about 500,000 people lost their lives on both sides. The MEK at that time, who did they side with? Not Iran against the aggressor. They sided with Iraq. They sided with Saddam Hussein. And that is something that Iranians of all different political stripes will remember about the MEK and say they're not a legitimate group. But John Bolton thinks they're legitimate, and they have a lot of money, which some people speculate is coming from Saudi Arabia, and they are using that money in the good old U.S. tradition to buy politicians. And they buy politicians in the U.S. from the left and the right. They offer them enormous amounts of money, up to $100,000 for a speaking engagement. They have bought Howard Dean on the left in the Democrats. They bought John Bolton on the right, or Rudy Giuliani, who is now the legal advisor to Trump. He was their keynote speaker of the MEK at the convention that they just had. And he, as well as John Bolton, says to them, 2018, we will see you back in Iran, as if the government is going to be squeezed so hard economically in Iran that the people are going to rise up and they're going to put in power this group, the MEK, that until 2012 was on the terrorist list in the United States and does not have a base of support inside Iran. There is a Iranian-American, Jason Rezaian, who is a Washington Post reporter who was captured and imprisoned in Iran for a long time on trumped-up charges, has very good reason to hate the Iranian government. He just wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, and he said, there is no plan B. The U.S. has no plan B. There is no group that could take the place of the present government right now. So one has to wonder, well, what is the plan? And what some people speculate is the plan is chaos. Let chaos reign inside Iran. Let there be a civil war inside Iran. Let the minority groups in the that live along the borders of Iran rise up. Let different dissident groups rise up. And this would be good for the Israelis because then you would have a broken up, dismembered, weak country of Iran instead of a strong country of 80 million people. Well, we don't know what the end game is, but it doesn't look good for the Iranian people. And so we have to think, what are the possibilities of avoiding war? Well, the big possibility is to try to keep the Iranian deal, nuclear deal, in place. The U.S. withdrew, but the other countries have not withdrawn. And we have to strengthen the Europeans to try to get them to not only stay in the deal, but make sure their companies can do business with Iran without incurring U.S. sanctions. Because the only way the Iranian government is going to stay in this deal is if there is some benefit for the Iranian people. The other thing we have to do is make it very clear, as if it wasn't clear enough in the U.S. Constitution, where it is the Congress and not the president that has the responsibility to declare war, there is an amendment now to say to Donald Trump, you do not have the authority to intervene militarily in Iran. It is passed in the House. We want it to pass in the Senate so that it will be crystal clear that it is illegal for Trump to take any military action in Iran. Other things we can do, create more daylight between the U.S. and the Saudis. Stop the weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. There will be another vote coming up soon on weapons sales. The last vote, we got close to stopping it. We got 44 senators. We need 51. And we need to have Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris early on say they will vote against any weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. We also need to create more daylight between the U.S. government and Israel. And we have the wonderful a vote that happened today in the UN General Assembly that condemned Israel for the excessive use of force in Gaza by an overwhelming positive vote. And that is something that we have to keep movement on, and we are lucky that we have Bernie Sanders, who is changing the discourse among politicians by saying the Palestinian people have human rights and that the Israelis do not have the right to shoot at peaceful protesters, as just happened in Gaza. And the world did not fall. AIPAC, the lobby group, did not come in and demand his resignation. He continues to be the most popular politician in the United States. So let's get Kamala Harris, Dianne Feinstein, and other politicians to rise to that same bar that Bernie Sanders has set for us. Another thing that we can do is look at who is benefiting from these constant wars that we are in? And if you scratch beneath the surface, that is the weapons manufacturers. They want to keep us in a constant state of war. In fact, when the CEO of Boeing was asked if he was concerned now that a contract for civilian airplanes with Iran would not be able to go through because of Donald Trump, he basically said, well, that's too bad, but we'll make even more money by the continued conflict in the Middle East. They are merchants of death, as Pope Francis has called them. And we have a new campaign with Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, about 70 different groups. You can go on the website called divestfromthewarmachine.org and see the different ways that we can work to withdraw our support from the war machine. We can pass city council resolutions to that effect. We can go to our universities and say, we don't want our endowments or investments in weapons companies. We hook up with the students who are saying, don't support the NRA and say, include the weapons manufacturers. We can go to the pension funds and we can go to our politicians and say, every year you vote on a massive, bloated Pentagon budget that gives so much of our tax dollars away to these companies because the companies get half of the Pentagon budget. And then they use a little bit to bribe our politicians. So we're saying to our politicians, take a pledge. No NRA money and no money from the weapons companies. So finally, I want to end by paying tribute to an American who died very recently, much loved by many people, not only in this country, but around the world, and that is Anthony Bourdain. And I want to give you a quote that somebody sent to me from Anthony Bourdain, and it said this. It said, Iran was mind-blowing. My crew has never been treated so well by total strangers everywhere. We had heard that Persians were nice, but the nicest? We didn't see that coming. I quote that because, one, it's true. The Iranians are the nicest people you could ever find, so let's make sure we talk to this lovely Iranian man right here. Also because his job was a job that was teaching Americans to love the rest of the world, teaching Americans about countries that we have never been to, people we don't know, and showing all the beauty in them, their wonderful different cuisine, the different drinks that they've come up with, the way they interact with each other, going into their homes, learning about their customs, laughing, joking with them. And it just broke down so many barriers, whether it was Anthony Bourdain in Gaza or Anthony Bourdain, what was your favorite? Do you want to yell out one you liked? West Virginia was a very good one. Anybody else have a favorite? France, yeah, well, how can you not like the French cuisine? Vietnam. I mean, he took us to places that people can oftentimes not go by themselves, but learn so much from them. And what we learned was there is a big, beautiful world out there. There are wonderful people out there. They might do things differently from us. They might even do some things better than us, like public transportation or Medicare for all. And that it's a world there, we can teach them some of the best things of our culture, but we can also learn from them. And so as we pay tribute to Anthony Bourdain, let's remember that instead of going around the world bombing water treatment facilities and bombing clinics and bombing people's homes and marketplaces, it would be a much better world for all of us if we did what Anthony Bourdain did, which is to sit down with people from West Virginia to Gaza to Iran and enjoy each other's company and recognize it is a wonderful, beautiful world if we will only open up our arms and use them for hugging instead of killing. Thank you. So we have some time for questions, discussions, and let's try to keep comments kind of short so that we can get quite a number of them, and I'll repeat them. So, yeah, so the question was, there's a whole history of failed peace efforts in the past, and does this one have more chances of succeeding? I think that it does for a number of reasons. One, because on the negative side, what North Korea has done to really frighten the Japanese, to frighten the people of Guam, to frighten people in the U.S., to really say, now we not only have nuclear weapons, we have the capacity to send them to other countries. So it's not just the people in the South who are living under that fear, but it's a broader circle. And I think that gives some more momentum to say, okay, maybe we really need to find ways to denuclearize. The other is that there is a young person in charge now who seems to be more interested than his father or grandfather in the past of actually moving to a direction of not only denuclearization, but peace with the South. The South now has a president who, in the previous, when there was a round of peace talks earlier, not with the last government, but one before, it was President Moon who was in charge of that. So he has a history, and he knows how to negotiate. And he's a very, very smart, seasoned diplomat. And then, you know, you have the phenomena of only Nixon could go to China. Let's face it, Barack Obama could not have met with Kim Jong-un. It just wouldn't have happened. The right would attack him so much, just even at the thought of doing that, he couldn't have gotten away with it. And Donald Trump can get away with it. So I'd say that there's a multiplicity of factors that makes it more likely that this peace effort will actually work.
Would you give some odds?
The odds I would give it are 70 to 30. That's pretty good, right?
We all want peace. I want to make it
to you. You can do it. So this was saying to people that you can look at your own retirement funds, that some of them are invested in a company, Vanguard, that is one of the leading investors in drones, and that we can also look, we are doing a campaign against the enormous investment firm called BlackRock that has billions of dollars invested in the weapons companies, and we're going to the home of the CEO, we're going to their corporate headquarters, we're going to their shareholder meetings, and if you go online to the CodePink.org website, you can find out more about that campaign. And one other thing I wanted to add, when you talk about investments, it's also what you do personally in your life and how you use your expertise. And I was really excited when I saw that about 4,000 employees of Google signed a letter saying they did not want their company to be involved in a Pentagon contract around technology for drone warfare. And there was such an uproar that they were successful in getting Google to say it would not renew its contract with the Pentagon. So let's see, yes. So the question is, what exactly is the United States doing when it comes to Saudi Arabia and Yemen? And when I say Saudi Arabia, I'll also add the Emirates, because they are working together on that. The U.S. is supplying the weapons, is supplying the airplanes, is refueling the airplanes in the air, is giving logistical support, and is providing diplomatic cover. And so when the U.S. says that, well, we can't tell the Saudis what to do, like right now when they are trying to take over this port of Hodeidah, BS, call BS on that. Donald Trump could stop that in 1 minute if he wanted to. Just yesterday, there was a bombing of a Doctors Without Borders clinic that was a cholera treatment clinic. Well, guess what? The Saudis are so underhanded that they put out a fake report saying that Doctors Without Borders forgot to give them the coordinates of this clinic. And Doctors Without Borders called BS on them and say, we've given you these coordinates over and over and over again. You knew that this was a clinic. And the U.S. has been complicit in all of these bombings.
I have a live mic here, and I'd like to ask a question and then pass it off to the next person. But can you tell us about drone warfare and why it's important to resist drone warfare?
So some of you in this room are as old as I am, and we know the Vietnam War, and there was a draft at that time. And because there was a draft and young men were being sent off against their will to go to war in a place they didn't know, to kill people they didn't know, there was something called the Vietnam Syndrome, which meant that for years and years and years after that, there was a reluctance on the part of governments to send a lot of U.S. soldiers to war. Well, that was broken at the time of Iraq, when over 100,000 Americans were sent there and to Afghanistan. But the same thing has happened, which Americans don't like to see Americans dying. Unfortunately, they don't care enough about the Afghans, the Iraqis, the Yemenis, all the others who are victims of our wars, but they don't want to see the Americans dying. And so the U.S. military and the government came up with this alternative, which is drone warfare. So you have people in the United States, like in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, who sit very comfortably in a cushioned seat in an air-conditioned room and press a button to kill people overseas. And it's the most inhumane, immoral kind of warfare that you can imagine, because there is no risk on our side. And now there is efforts to by Donald Trump to increase, and he has increased the use of drone warfare in many places, including in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Somalia. And so we have to do everything we can to continue to expose the inhumanity of drone warfare and demand an end to it.
So my question, is this live? Okay. My question is about the what I call the corporate Democrats, and it seems like it's the corporate Democrats that are putting down Trump for this peace deal that he's working toward. How would you comment on how much of a threat that might be to the eventual success of this endeavor?
So what might the threat be of the corporate Democrats? And I would say the corporate Democrats are also the Democrats most influenced by the strongest lobby group on foreign policy issues in the United States, and that is AIPAC. That is the Israeli government lobby group. And so you see, it's the same people in the Democratic Party. They get money from AIPAC-related organizations, and they get a lot of money from the corporations. And they are the ones who want to continue with the constant state of warfare. They are the ones who vote for every war. They're the ones who vote for the bloated Pentagon budget. And they're the ones that are going to give Donald Trump a hard time. It's extremely dangerous because it keeps us in the state of perpetual war. But also, if Donald Trump wants to get a treaty signed with North Korea, he's going to need some Democrats in there. And the Democrats are already saying, you know, we're going to be very reluctant to give our votes unless this is a treaty that we say has all of these different elements to it. And so it is extremely dangerous, and that's why I think there has to be people power behind this treaty in North Korea, and people power to stop us from going into another war in Iran.
So on a daily basis, I listen to Democracy Now. I check out The Intercept and Code Pink, and then Comedy Central. But to balance
good balance
it all.
There, yes.
But, how do you keep yourself informed on a daily basis?
Well,
it's
a good question, and I think it's a collective question. So maybe people want to shout out what, aside from Democracy Now! And KZFR, of course, what, and The Intercept, you said, what are some of your favorite sources of information?
Consortium
News?
Project Censored.
What other?
Critical Media Literacy.
France 24. It's a wonderful channel from France. KPFA. Read some books. Russia Today, RT, Al Jazeera. China Global. Now, isn't it interesting we're saying so many news outlets that are outside the U.S.? including many people listen to BBC. And, you know, I think we have given up too much by allowing the big cable news companies to take our airways and use it for crap, constant crap, without really teaching us. Propaganda on both sides. And we have to do something to try to take back the airwaves.
Yeah. So I have your new book here, Inside Iran, and I'm seeing the symbol up here. So I wanted to ask you about it, its meaning and symbolism.
Well, I've just used the symbol of the Islamic Republic, and it's just to say this is about the Islamic Republic of Iran. But as I try to do in the book, I try to be very balanced about how I look at Iran, because I think there's a stereotyping of Iranians that they're all just sheep in this religious group that determines everything. And yet it's a really, really vibrant society. And although women are forced to wear a headscarf, women are so active in every single aspect of society. The last two times I've been there, I've been able to go to Women's Business Association because I want to learn how the sanctions are affecting them, and they are. But you see women who are architects and engineers with PhDs, and they have their own companies, and they're making medical equipment, and they're doing all kinds of amazing things. So it is a much more modern, sophisticated country than most people realize.
I would add to that list of sources, Mother Jones.
Mother Jones Magazine, online, of course. Yeah.
But through your talk, you've mentioned a number of political allies, Bernie and many others. I wonder if you would comment on some of the journalistic allies that have delved into Iran, like Seymour Hersh, or especially Gareth Porter, the integrity of especially Gareth Porter as a source.
Yes, Gareth Porter, if you don't know him, he has done wonderful work on Iran, and he has a great piece out now about North Korea where he looks at exactly that issue that you were talking about in the what happened to past. You know, it's blamed so much on North Korea that they would not keep up the end of their bargain, and Gareth Porter goes into what had the U.S. done to not keep up its end of the bargain. And I think we talked about The Intercept. There are wonderful people in The Intercept, from Glenn Greenwald. There's a guy at The Intercept called Lee Fang, who's done really good work about the lobby groups. There's a William Hartung, who is somebody I adore, who does fabulous work about the military-industrial complex. And has been our best source of information about weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. There's Phyllis Bennis, who some of you might know from the Institute for Policy Studies, who is really brilliant. We have a lot of great reporters. Unfortunately, you have to search them out, and it's not probably going to be in the New York Times or the Washington Post.
I have it. Don't you think it's about time that we have a third and fourth political party in our country?
I think it's way beyond time that we had a third or fourth political party in this country. The problem is the system is rigged, and the system is rigged in favor of the two parties. And until we do things to get rid of some of the problems, whether it's the Electoral College, the way that the gerrymandering, the way that you can't get into a debate if you're in the third party, the incredibly corrupting role of money in politics so that journalists, the press won't even take you seriously unless you've raised a significant amount of money. Just even getting on the ballot as a third party, every single state in this nation has a different requirement. So those are hoops that are very, very hard to jump through. But I totally agree, we need third parties. So I think on that note,
would you like to wrap up, say one more thing?
Okay, so in wrapping up right now, I have really enjoyed this as well as the discussion. I think one thread that's been going through this is really about information and how we live in a society where so many of our the American people are ignorant, and that does lead to apathy. So our work is really to expose them to this wonderful community radio station, to expose them to all these great other sources of media, and to find out ways that we can demand that the airwaves get back into the hands of American people to educate us about what's really happening in the world. And lastly, you can also go to codepink.org and sign up and join us in our efforts to change our government's policies. Thank you.
You've been listening to Medea Benjamin in the KZFR studios. We want to thank everyone in-house and also those of you listening. We're going to switch over to Radio Paradise. I want to let you know this is KZFR, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And anyway, Rick Anderson is in the studio, and he